Yesterday, we proved the Lieb-Robinson bounds. That are a statement that in a local, non-relativistic, quantum mechanical system, which is locally finite dimensional, but then becomes infinite dimensional in the thermodynamic limit, there is an emergent light cone. And so again, the hypothesis is that our Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators. So this means the diameter of X is bounded by number R. That the volume of every X is bounded by a number sigma. That the strength of these local interactions is bounded by a number kappa. And then we introduce the variable psi equal A over lambda, where lambda is just a number and A is the lattice spacing. Then the Lieb-Robinson bounds can be expressed in this form in terms of the norm of the commutator between two local operators placed at two points A and B of the lattice, and this can be bounded by some constant times e to the minus d minus bt over xi, where the Lieb-Robinson speed v is 2k sigma e to the lambda r over lambda. Okay. So this is what we showed yesterday. So today we want to see some consequences of this theorem that are very important in condensed matter theory. So the first consequence is to show that if this is true, then the light cone really behaves like a light cone. So this means that there should be no signaling between A and B. And of course, this no means what we know. The light cone is fuzzy. So it means that there is some information that can leak out, but it is exponentially suppressed. So that whatever signal we send out of the light cone, the strength of the signal is exponentially small in this distance. Okay, which pretty much means that you cannot detect it. Exponential decay it is fast. Okay. So how do we do that? Let's see. Okay, so imagine that this is our system, and we have A that has support on a bunch of spins located here, and B that has a support on a bunch of spins located there. And we call the rest of the system C. Okay? So what I'm saying is that my Hilbert space, I write it in this way. Okay? And I have an initial state of the system that is rho zero. Rho zero is an initial state for the whole system ABC. Okay. Then A wants to try to send a signal to B. And all A can do, by definition of A, is to do operations that have support on A. So A is localized in the sense that can only operate here. And without loss of generality, it also makes the proof simpler. We will assume that A can operate with a unitary operation UAK. So what is K? K labels the different operations that they can choose. Okay. So for a certain value of K, I do a certain rotation in the Hilbert space of the qubits on A. For a different K, I do another one. But we will say, we will call U0 doing nothing, doing the identity. Okay? Then I let the system evolve with the system Hamiltonian. Okay? So we have an Hamiltonian on H, ABC. H, ABC is this one. And this Hamiltonian is local. So that we can use the Lib-Robinson bounds. Yep.
Just to clarify there, you mentioned that the K is indicating some sense rotations that you're making to your qubit. So couldn't you just have an infinitesimal rotation operator and then repeated operations of those?
Sure. Whatever it is, in the end, is some unitary operation.
Okay.
I'm assuming that A has full access to the Hilbert space on A,
okay,
and can do any quantum operation on it. And in fact, this means that in principle, A can do more than just unitary operations. It could do any operation that brings a quantum state to another quantum state. So I am restricting to just unitary operations for the sake of simplicity, but it's not too difficult to extend to any type of operation. That in quantum mechanics, I don't know if you know, they're called completely positive maps. So it's whatever map that takes a density matrix and brings it in another density matrix, something that has trace one. Okay, so we operate with a unitary operation so that our state now encodes this message K, right? So our state rho on ABC depends on K in this way. So you have UK A rho 0 UK dagger. So K contains the message, right? If K is zero, I'm not sending any message because I'm not doing anything. Right? So I'm not writing anything on A that wants to be sent on B through the evolution with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so how does my state evolve? it evolves with the unitary operator given by the Hamiltonian evolution. And just to be clear, I put here ABC, because this is the global state unitary evolution induced by this H. That is a H on HABC. And even if it's local, but it has support everywhere. It's local in the usual sense that it is the sum of local operators. Very good. So what is our output? Okay. So this state will evolve in time and will evolve like UABC of T, rho K ABC, U dagger ABC of T. Right? And you know that now this object for every T has a support everywhere. Right? This is the problem that originated our question of locality. So it has support everywhere, so B in principle can read a message. But what does B have access to? B doesn't have access to this whole state, but only on the part of the state that has support on B, which by definition is the trace over A and C of this state. So this is called, we call it sigma BK of T. Right? So it's the state of B at the time T obtained by evolution through the global Hamiltonian after I've written on A a message K. So in order to show that there can be no signaling, what I want to show is that if I consider the same thing when I write nothing, so if I consider sigma 0 of B at the time t, so you know when B will start making measurements on here, he will find the quantum state there, and he will find outputs, right? And these are the outputs. All the results of his observations are encoded in this density matrix. But this is the density matrix when A didn't send any signal, okay? So saying that signaling is impossible means that there is no difference in the output of measurements that B can do when I measure on here and when I measure on here, which mathematically is, so this same statement is the trace distance between these two operators is zero, or in our case is upper bounded by something that decays exponentially. So let's see. Let's show it. Okay, so imagine that B can measure some observable O with the support on B, right? So the expectation value of B when the state sigma is a sigma zero B of T will be just the trace of OB on this state, sigma 0 B of T. Right? This is the expectation value of an operator. Whereas in general, for some k different from 0, it will be this thing. Now we want to take the difference between these expectation values. What do I put first? Da servire. And show this that is small. Okay. So the trace distance is nothing but the greatest of all these differences that I can achieve for any O of B. Okay? So this is somehow the trace distance. Is the most discriminating measurement, right? This is what we saw. Okay. So let's plug in some of the things that we know. So what is this? This is the trace of our observable OB of T. Okay, let me do all the passages. Right? Because everything is linear. Ah, what? Yeah. Sure. No, it's true. I need the absolute value here.
Okay, afterward, yeah. I mean, right now.
Oh, so now this is like this. I'm not bounding anything. It is just like this. Okay. I'm just rewriting these things here and using linearity in OB. Okay. Now I use the cyclicity of the trace. Okay. So you know that this object means. Okay. Let me do it. So as a function of t, this means that I have ut, let me call the difference of the matrix at time 0, delta sigma of 0, u dagger t. Okay. Now I use the cyclicity of the trace, so I can put this u dagger over here. So the cyclicity of the trace basically is the proof of the fact that the Heisenberg representation and the Schrödinger representation tell you the same thing, because now this becomes the expectation value on this time-dependent operator of this time-independent operator, of this time-independent state. That is also an operator as a density matrix, but it is the state of the system. So let me spell out what is this delta sigma. So this is just rho 0 minus uka rho 0 uka dag. So why is this? Because this was the global state, right? Whereas here, I have this delta sigma that should carry B. The reason why I can forget B is because the support of the operator that I'm measuring on the state is on B. So it is the same thing if I just take the global state or the reduced state to B. So you can show it's the same thing. This is a simple exercise that you can do. Okay, so this is true. All right. And okay, so you see that there is a commutator forming here, because I can multiply everything for u dagger k uk. So this becomes the trace. Just verify this identity. U dagger a uka commutator ob. I have just inserted in here the identity, which is UKA dagger UK. And then you obtain this. Oh, we have the commutator. Okay. So this is the commutator between something as a function of time on B and something at time zero on A. So it has exactly the form that we have in our Lib-Robinson bound, apart from the fact that I've exchanged A and B, but that doesn't matter at all. Right? So this is playing the role of OA, of A of T, and this is playing the role of B. A and B are just labels, doesn't matter. Okay, so I can bound this, and of course, I've always forgotten everywhere my absolute values. Okay. So this is smaller than, well, remember some constant that in our case is 2, the norm of A, but A is unitary, so it's norm 1, the norm of B, and then the exponential part. So this proves that here. So if I write a signal K by doing some specific operation that is not trivial on A, which is not just the identity that is doing nothing, this will result in some partial state on B called sigma KB, which is undistinguishable from the state that I obtain on B when I do nothing, apart from an exponential tail. So I make an exponentially small error if I approximate sigma KB with sigma 0B. So I can, this signal is negligible, I cannot see it. So this is no signal. Yeah.
Just generalize this with CPTV Max. How would the argument change in any way? What key part of the argument?
Let me see. So of course you would have somewhere the map of the CP map, but that's not a problem. The norm of the CP map, because but that is not a problem.
Yeah. Well, you can just introduce nuts.
Maybe it just carries through the same. Yeah.
I mean, I would say you could just introduce an environment that is not part of the many-body system. So you could imagine that A has access to A and an external environment, then just do the same unitary on that.
But that
whole thing.
No, okay, so you are bringing up something more complicated, if I understand. So your colleague is just saying, is there any loss of generality in considering this state? Did we use anywhere the fact that this thing was unitary? And the answer is no, we only used it here. So there will be some additional norm. But what you are bringing up is something, if I understand correctly, when you talk about environment, you are bringing up that the whole system ABC is also in touch with an environment, right? Is this what you're saying?
Well, more specifically, that A is in touch with an environment.
Oh, okay. Then it's the same. Then, yes, it's like doing some unitary operation on a slightly larger space of A,
yeah,
some ancillary space, and then tracing over that ancillary space, you forget it. And then in this way, you have any possible density matrix on A. So, yeah, it just makes... Just I don't have to think about norms here. Okay. So this is the first result, no signaling, right? Why did you do that? Okay, that's not to come back.
Use manual.
It's manual. It disappeared. It doesn't come back. Okay. Anyway, so first result, no signaling. Okay, second thing. I am dumb, but. Okay, but can I have my blackboard back? Thank you.
What changes if I consider an infinite dimensional qubit space?
Okay, so let me take 5 minutes to the whole proof of the Lieber-Robinson bounds as is collapses. Because the norms of this phi axis are unbounded on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Unless you only consider bounded operators on that. But then there is no reason to introduce infinite dimensional Hilbert space to start with. But your question stands, because is that an artifice of the proof that we had to use finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, or it's really like that. So it seems that it is an artifice of the theorem. In fact, we proved, me and some collaborators proved that if phi of x is unbounded, it is what it is. So it is whatever. So it can be bounded or not. But if the commutators are bounded, then you can make another theorem that is an but it's a different technique. So instead of, you remember, to prove the theorem, we went to see the first derivative and then we integrated. But now somehow we are looking at the commutators. And the commutator is like taking a derivative. So you have to do the same proof, but you have to go to the second derivative, and then it becomes a bit hairier. So if this is bounded, let me finish, then you have a bound. So it is not so important whether the local system is infinite dimensional or not, but if the exchange, when they exchange information between two nearby systems, is bounded. If they can only exchange a finite amount of energy, which is more physical, then you have a bound.
So I was thinking, for example, if I consider just a system of spin with interaction like in the Ising model, the XY model, this works pretty fine because the operators are bounded. But if I consider a many-body system with Coulomb interaction, let's say, where your operators are unbounded, then that means that in those systems, I don't have this emergent causality structure.
No, it means that you cannot do the theorem.
Sure, but I mean,
in that way.
Okay, but there's still a causality structure in that system.
Okay, so in a Coulomb system, you have two issues. One is that they are unbounded. And maybe that can be, now there is a sort of, there are several different results. This is one. Another one is with harmonic systems, with harmonic oscillators. So that probably works because you can quantize it in terms of harmonic oscillators. However, the problem there is that the interactions are Coulomb, which means that they are long-ranged. So this proof will always fail if the interactions are long range. You see, the range of our interactions was R, was finite. Now you can redo the theorem if instead of, because you are doing an exponential error anyway, if the range of your interaction is, if your interactions are exponentially decaying, so this, we still say it's finite range because it's like a finite correlation length, then you can still do the theorem. But for bare charges, you cannot do that. Anyway, this is not really a problem because you know that the system of bare bare charges is not stable in the thermodynamic limit. And the only way to talk about many charges together is to take in account the fact that that you have together positive and negative charges. So what I'm saying is that you cannot have a stable system of just electrons. No, it would explode. So there is no statistical mechanics of a system of just electrons. The free energy blows up. And that it is exactly because the interactions are long range. But if you put together electrons and protons, they screen, and the effective interaction is exponential. It's exponential. It's not Coulomb-like anymore, and then everything follows. You had a question?
Yeah, I presume that this sort of reduces to the usual no-circling Newman theorem in some special case. What special case would that be?
Is the theorem?
Well, the usual non-circling theorem would say, I think, that this trace over AC gives exactly equal to...
It would be zero.
Yeah.
In the non-signaling theorem. And we are saying it's exponentially small.
So what's the difference between those? What you've done here and the usual non-signaling theorem?
Yeah, that is not exactly zero. If you do it in quantum field theory, you find zero. The light cone is sharp. Our light cone is fuzzy because you make an exponentially small error.
So what assumption is different in the proof of the usual non-signaling theorem?
Oh, because in the usual non-signaling theorem, so you do not prove it in this way, but you start with a theory that has a light cone.
So you start with the light cone.
Yes, you have to impose the Lorentz symmetry.
Right, that makes sense.
Here we didn't impose any symmetry, any Lorentz symmetry. It's emergent. It's emergent with the small error. Okay.
With small enough scales, the Ransom period break down in some sense?
Say it again?
So at high energies, then nuclear Ransom period should break down according to this?
So tell me what you mean by high energy.
Like when you're going to very, very short scales.
Right. So here there is no Lorentz symmetry to break down. I didn't say that there is a Lorentz symmetry. I just said that there is an emergent light cone. Is this Lorentz symmetry,
emergent Lorentz symmetry, there's an emergent light cone which is
So what you say is that if I had a theory in which there is emergent, more than a light cone, but a true, so this is a piece, it's not Lorentz symmetry yet, but you can make lattice models with an emergent Lorentz symmetry. And this Lorentz symmetry would break down at the lattice level. When you go at high energy.
Yeah.
So this type of models, when you want to describe the emergence of symmetry or the emergence of things like gravity, of forces, They are very interesting because they show you what are the minimal ingredients to obtain a certain type of physics. And they also show you that maybe you can obtain this type of physics not postulating it as elementary, but as an effective theory. However, they never prove or give you an indication that you believe that nature at the microscopic level is really like that. So I am never taking a stance whether, for instance, space-time is continuous or not. So the fact that we have a discrete model is just for the sake of modeling. And we can obtain some results. That doesn't mean that we are assuming that space-time is discrete. Okay, let me go ahead and okay. Correlations. That's it. There is no signaling, but as your colleague would probably know, it is possible to have long-range correlations without signaling. Correlations are weaker. Right? So this is what you could have in an EPR pair. Right? You cannot use an EPR pair to send a signal, but there are correlations that are stronger than classic. So what about correlations? So if I start with some state that has correlation length psi, and then I evolve with a local system, maybe I want to obtain a state that has correlation length chi that is greater than psi. Can I say that to do this, it is required a time that is like this? Can I say that also correlations, if they are obtained by means of local evolution, they also have to increase linearly in time? There is a speed for the propagation of correlations. Okay? So this is not implied by the no signaling, but it's another result of the Lieber-Robinson bounds. And so this is one of your tutorials, and you will prove exactly this, that if I take OA of t and OB of t, so I want to measure these correlations. So this is bounded by x of minus d minus vt over, so let me put, this is the initial correlation length. This is the initial correlation length plus 2 chi. So you can only increase the correlation by 2 chi if you wait a time that is of the order d.
What is chi again?
So chi is, I start with the state as correlation length psi, and I want to obtain, after a time t, a state that has correlation length chi.
Okay.
And I can only do that if I wait enough time such that I can reach B. Okay, so this is material for the tutorial. So everything so far is dynamical, right? We are preparing some state, then evolving with the Hamiltonian, and we see what happens in time. But we are also interested, we are very much interested in the static result. So, which is when t is equal to 0, and now we take this average onto the ground state of a gapped system. So in other words, this Lieb-Mathis-Schütz theorem, we want to show that connected correlation functions at the time 0 are exponentially bound. And the gap of the system appears here. And we can prove this when the ground state is unique. So now we have a basically a technical difficulty, because the thing that is changing here is that here now we do not have time evolution. And sorry, here I'm making a mistake. What I want here is this. There's no time evolution, as I was saying. And Xi is just the gap, the inverse gap. So how do we use our results on the Lee Robinson bounds that is dynamical for something that is static? Okay, so I'll show you a sketch of the proof. So we go to a spectral representation of our correlation functions.
What is L in there?
Oh, this is just the distance between A and B. Okay. So we first find a convenient representation for our correlation functions. And then one needs to prove a lemma, which is basically it's a weak rotation in which this time scale becomes the gap, the inverse gap. But I will not do I will not prove the lemma because it's exceptionally long and complicated. So at some point I will give you the lemma. And if you want to see the full proof, I can give you reference for that. Okay, so let's consider a set of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And B, AMN, BMN, the matrix elements of A and B in this basis. Okay. And we are concerned with, so although the theorem is based on the connected correlation function, so I'm subtracting the average of A and the average of B, one can put these two averages to zero without loss of generality. So I really want to prove a theorem for just the correlation function. Okay, so let me call f of t what I called yesterday, just the expectation value in the ground state. In the ground state, say, is zero. Okay? So what is this? This is equal to zero. Spelled out the commutator. Now, remember that our evolution operator has a very simple form in the basis of the eigenstates, of course. Okay, so I insert this object everywhere here, and we get
then we have this part, and this is I again. Here, because of these parts and this, and the cat that comes from the other side, I just get the matrix elements of these guys. Okay.
Is A a symmetric operator?
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. So shouldn't either of those, shouldn't it be A and M and A M N?
Let me see. So, let me see. No, this is A and M. And this other one. No, it is okay. It is like this. Let me continue on this one. So here, of course, I get two deltas, delta 0n and delta 0m. So in the end, I have just, and then I relabel n in m. So this is the spectral representation of F, that is the expectation value of our commutator. And this part is called F plus of T, and this part is called F minus of T. Okay, and now basically I have to do the lemma.
Are you assuming that E0 is 0?
What?
Are you assuming without loss of generality that E0 is 0?
No, I assume that this thing is, and this is the only assumption I made, and here there is no loss of generality.
However, when you replace the E0 EN as a delta, the energy is in exponentials.
Oh, that's not a problem. The zero point energy.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you have to notice is that F plus of T, so this part, F plus of T, as t goes to 0, it's just A0MBM0, which means is our correlation function. Okay. So the technique now to a bound first shows a bound between the difference between these two objects, and then a bound just on this one. And putting the two bounds together, we have a bound just on this piece. And they both require this complicated weak rotation. I give you the result that F plus of 0, so that is our correlation function, is bounded from above by a constant. Then we have A, B, then we have the exponential of something that is of the order L over R. R is the range of our interactions in our local Hamiltonian. plus 2. Okay, here we have a prefactor that contains a lot of stuff, but it's still just a prefactor. Again, A, B. And now the important part. This would be called L, sorry. L delta E over 2. OK. So this is the final bound.
Two questions. First one is, you said this theorem holds if the ground state is unique.
Yeah.
Right? However, in this construction.
Yeah, we used it here, where I just put a unique ground state.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's not unique, I still have subspace in my ground state, and the discussion is exactly the same.
Yeah, no, but this final part of the bound would not hold. So it must. Yeah.
And the second thing is, you said that F plus going as t goes to 0 gives you the correlation function that we want.
Yeah.
What happens with F minus at t equals 0?
It's something else that we don't care, but. What I'm saying, I said that you can find first a bound on F, mm-hmm. and then a bound on the difference between F plus and F minus. And putting the two bounds together, you obtain a weaker bound just on F plus,
okay.
and which is this one. Okay. So this is order of L over R. Okay. So we are interested in correlation functions at long distance. Okay. So R is something that is small. It's the range of our interactions. So we can neglect this term. We look always at things at long distance. And this is the promised result. Here there is the gap. Here there is the Lieb-Robinson speed. The gap is playing the role of the time. So we can define a correlation length that is like this and get the promised result that this is proportional to some constant alpha e to the minus L over x. So this is the Lieb-Matisch-Schütz theorem. That was proven in this form by Matthew Hastings in 2004 or 2005, I don't remember. And proof does not depend on the dimension of the space. It is always true. Okay, so we have seen how locality plays a very important role in quantum many body physics because it tells us, first of all, why non-relativistic quantum mechanics is still good for quantum many-body systems, with a far extended, in which we are interested in long distances. We know that relativistic corrections are small. And second, we see that this local structure determines the structure of correlation. So what type of correlations are possible, both dynamically as time evolution goes, or statically in the ground state of the system? So we now have a we have seen that if you have a gap and a unique ground state, then you are bound to have exponential decay correlation functions. And we know that if the ground state is not unique, we cannot prove it. But is it necessary? So is it possible to have a gap and a degenerate ground state and having fast decaying correlation functions? So we have seen, I think, in the first lecture that if there is a symmetry breaking, then we have a long-range order. Then correlation functions do not decay exponentially. So somehow this question means, is it possible to have a gapped system with a degenerate ground state without breaking any symmetry? Is another way of posing this question. And this is the topic that we start tomorrow. So to go beyond symmetry breaking in quantum many bodies. Questions?
Yeah. What happens if I have no gap? Let's say, I mean, the gap, of course, enters here in the bound. But still, I can say something about correlation functions.
Typically, they have a power law.
They're a power law, okay.
No.
All right, because it's the same as saying as setting the correlation length to infinity, and it's near criticality.
Excellent. Okay. Tomorrow.